My name is Tamara, and we're back today. We have another episode for you. So I'm joined today by a guest, and I'm going to let him introduce himself.
So first of all, thank you, Tamara, for having me today.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you. My name is Brian Gagne Henry. I'm actually a Concordia alumni myself.
Okay.
So I graduated in 2021 in accountancy and finance at JMSB, more specifically. Since then, I have become a financial planner and more specifically work in the business development role at Ferrick Investment Services. So now you might ask who Ferrick Investment Services is. So we are actually the principal distributor of Ferrick Funds, which is a nonprofit organization that distributes mutual funds and offers financial advice and financial planning services specifically for engineering professionals in Quebec. This also includes engineering students, as well as the family members and businesses of our clients.
Okay, amazing. And I did not know you were a Concordia alumni. That's was left as a surprise for me. So you're one of our own. Well, thank you for coming today and for, discussing with me today. So we were planning on talking about home ownership.
Yes.
So I'm gonna let you start. What are the main points that people should know about wanting to own a home? How do they go about it? What are the steps?
Of course. So, first of all, with that being said, it's important to remember that financial advice is always a case-by-case scenario. So
Yeah.
everything said in today's recording is obviously for informational purposes only, so that I do recommend that you speak with the professional regarding your specific situation before applying any strategies that might be discussed today. So just a
Definitely.
little heads up before we get into anything.
Yeah.
But yes, regarding home ownership, obviously it's something that everybody would often like to be able to do in their lifetime, especially as students where we want to, get our degrees, go find ourselves some jobs that are going to allow us to have revenues that can allow
Yeah.
us to buy some properties. So the thing we really need to look at when preparing for home ownership is obviously starts with the first steps of financial planning, which is starting with a budget and, understanding what are the cash flows, what comes in, what comes out of our pay and our expenses. So that's obviously the first step. And why that's the first step for you personally is that it will also be the evaluation made by the bank or the mortgage broker when you do want to go and buy a home. So that's the first step, which is obviously the credit associated and knowing what are your ins and outs as terms of cash flow. So that is the first step to be able to understand how to get a mortgage to buy a house, because knowing the market we have today, obviously, we won't be paying our homes in cash. I know if you can,
Yeah.
good for you. But I know very, very little
In
people who
general.
exactly who are able to do that nowadays. But that does open the discussion for a new type of account that will actually become available during 2023, which we call the FHSA, which is the first home savings account. In French, it's what we call the CELI app. So the CELI, like as in TFSA, app, APP, as in achat première propriété. So the first home savings account is actually going to allow us to contribute up to $8,000 per year in the FHSA
Okay.
over up to a maximum of $40,000. So we can maximize the account over a 5-year period. And what that allows us to do is that when we contribute to the FHSA, we actually get a reduction of our gross annual income from our contribution. So what that means, and it's the same
Yeah.
thing as for an RSP, if you're familiar with how an RSP works, whereas if we have, let's say, an income of 40,000, we contribute 8,000 to the FHSA or the RRSP, our new taxable income would be 32,000. So the 40,000 minus the 8,000, that is what we would be taxed on. So
Okay.
the FHSA allows us to do that up to $40,000 over a 5-year period of time. The account can be open for a maximum of 15 years. So important to know if we are planning to buy a house only in 15 or 20 years, maybe wait a little bit before opening the
Yeah.
account because we have to transfer it out after that 15-year period. But what is interesting to know is that, let's say we want to buy a house in maybe 8 or 10 years, well, we still have an interest to open the account today, because even if we barely contribute today, next year we're going to be allowed to contribute what we didn't contribute in last year, if we were to say. So technically, we contribute up to $16,000 a year, but as long as the account was opened prior to the year where we make our initial contribution.
That makes sense. So when you say we, do you
Yes.
mean like like who exactly are we talking
Who's
about?
eligible? Perfect. It's actually for individuals who are at least 18 years of age, who are considered Canadian residents, and who have not lived in a home that they own in the last 4 years. So, for example, somebody can have rental properties, not live in them, and still use the FHSA for their own property afterwards. That's the little gray area in that aspect.
Okay, so they can still be eligible and like start it and start contributing to it.
Yes, in the case where they would have some rental property, maybe with their family or whatnot, maybe they're already involved in a family business, for example. And to outline really what's interesting of the FHSA, because I haven't gotten to the interesting part yet. Yes, we get a reduction from our gross annual income when we contribute, but what's really interesting is when we withdraw the money for our first home purchase, for example, we actually don't have to pay any taxes. So it's tax-free completely, no matter what the gains were inside of the account. And we do not have to reimburse anything to anyone over whatever said period of time. And the reason why I say that is because what we have currently in Canada, which has been around for a while, is what we call the Home Buyers Plan, so the HBP. And that plan is actually, like I said, already in place and is associated with the RRSP. So what that is it allows us to withdraw up to $35,000 from an RRSP, tax-free when we withdraw it. But after a 2-year period, we need to reimburse whatever we withdrew from our RRSP back into the RRSP. And if we don't, then we're taxed on that amount. So, yeah, so that's where the FHSA becomes really interesting, because we're allowed to get a deduction on our gross income, but never have to pay taxes when we use it for our first home purchase. So that becomes really interesting.
That's amazing. So just for those for like listeners who don't necessarily know, do you mind explaining quickly like what is an RSC?
Yes, of course. So an RRSP, as I briefly mentioned, well, the acronym stands for Registered Retirement Savings Plan, RRSP. And the goal of the RRSP is actually to reduce our current taxation, with the idea that we will declare a lower income in the future and then withdraw from the RRSP to pay less taxes. And what do I mean by that? So, as I mentioned, when we contribute to an RRSP, like the FHSA, we reduce our taxable income. So if we make 40,000 this year, reduce it by 8,000, we make 32,000 in the eyes of the government. So the goal of that is that we're going to have money put in. There's 3 steps basically to the RRSP. The first one is the contribution. We get the advantage of saving tax when we contribute. Then the second step is, while the money is inside the RRSP, it's actually generating revenues and income tax-free. So we're not, if we make money as the years go by, we're not taxed on that money
On
when it's
them.
inside the RRSP. But, and that's the big but, when we do withdraw it eventually, so ideally at retirement, we will be taxed on the amount that we withdraw. So, for example, that 8,000 that I mentioned, let's say it becomes 10,000 in a couple of years, and then we withdraw the 10,000. We're actually adding $10,000 to our gross annual income at that moment in time. So, ideally, to optimize the use of an RRSP, we want to contribute to the RRSP in our best earning years, where we know we're going to be making the highest income, and we want to withdraw when we're most likely retired and earning lower income and being in a lower tax bracket, which allows us obviously to save a bit in taxes, because we're always going to pay tax. It's just a matter of playing with, okay, we want to save a bit more today to pay a bit less later. So that's the main goal of the RRSP.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, actually. And how does there was one question I did want to ask you is how the government of Canada helps you with like helps home buyers, whether they're first time home buyers or just in general, like someone who's looking for that again. How do they help? Because I know that's, there might be different, I don't think that's the government that does this, but I'm just gonna ask anyway. There are different mortgages available. I mean, definitely not the government
Yes,
part of that.
well, to answer the first part of the question regarding the government, technically the Home Buyers Plan and the
That's part of that.
FHSA, exactly, those are actually federal government plans that were put in place to help home buyers purchase properties to have access to, their investments and tax-free advantages and whatnot. So that's the first step that the government has actually put in place to help home buyers, especially in today's economy and market for homes. So that's the first thing. There is some credits as well that are given for first-time home buyers. So when you buy your first home, you're actually allowed to deduct extra credits when you do your taxes at the end of the year. So that's something that can be added. So very interesting to know as a first-time home buyer. So that's what the government will mainly do on their end. Now, the second part of your question, I think, is more to understand the different mortgages, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's exactly because I read somewhere that there can be different mortgages based on your situation. I didn't look too much into it because I wanted to, ask you about it.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So there is technically different types of mortgages. There's a couple aspects to it. The product in itself is going to be often either a regular mortgage or what we call a home equity line of credit. So the difference between both is that a mortgage is like a car loan, for example, or a student loan where we're going to have a balance of X amount, let's say 200,000, and we're going to pay it over a 25-year period, and we're simply going to make the payments and renew our terms every 5 years, whether you have a fixed term or a variable term. That's up to you and the options available. But that's the first option, which is the regular mortgage, and at the end of the 25-year period, you're done paying, and that's it. You're cleared of debt. You paid your house. That's all. The other option, which is the home equity line of credit, is actually allows us to have some sort of revolving credit, such as a line of credit, attached to our mortgage. So what a mortgage is essentially is that if we aren't able to pay off our home, the bank or the broker is allowed to seize our property because they own it technically. We own the debt associated to it. So doing that with a line of credit allows us to actually use the asset of our home and the leverage of our home to fund any other projects, whether that be renovations for the property, whether that be, I want to start my own business, I want to buy a car and I don't want to go to a dealer to finance it. I have access to my home equity line of credit, and from there I can auto finance myself. And the advantage of that in some cases is that obviously interest rates are a lot lower than if you were to get a personal loan or a personal line of credit, because there is the guarantee of the property if ever you do not pay that debt. So that's why there's a certain risk that is not there or isn't there as much for the bank, because if ever you do not pay, well, it's in their interest because they'll have the property that you own. But it's in your interest to pay, obviously, because you still want to have a roof over your head.
Okay, that's super interesting. I didn't know any of that. Wow. Okay, sorry, I'm like recovering. I'm letting it all sink in. I don't know much about these things, so it's like this is a great way for me to learn.
Of course, for fun here.
What do you have any advice for any first time home buyers? Like any wisdom you would want to
Yeah,
share?
of course. I mean, kind of repeating a little bit from what I said at the beginning, the first step for anybody planning financially or whatnot is really to look at a budget to know what comes in, what comes out. That's for sure the first step. And in that budget, I will include the advice to pay yourself first. And what I mean by that is regarding investments, meaning that if you want to buy a house in 3 to 5 years and you want to accumulate $30,000 as a cash down, well, we're going to evaluate, okay, how much money do we need to put every pay or every week to get to that $30,000 in 3 to 5 years? And we're going to include it in our expenses, make it a recurring payment, as as would be for our cell phone or groceries or whatnot. We include the savings capacity or the savings part of that in our budget, and it allows us to actually achieve our goals the way we would like to by doing so. So that's one way. That's the first advice I would give. And added to that is what we often call an emergency fund. So
Okay.
obviously, if something happens, we want to be able to not have to touch money we put aside for a specific objective, such as a home purchase or a retirement or whatnot. So the emergency fund is often evaluated between 3 to 6 months of monthly income. So
Okay.
once again, depends for your situation, but we do recommend to have an emergency fund to help you.
Yeah, just in case something happens, like
Exactly,
rainy
exactly.
days.
Exactly, exactly.
Also, I'm so sorry, but the cat is attacking me. I don't know what I did, but I'm getting her off. Sorry about that.
No problem.
I got bit like 50 times while you were speaking, and I was trying not to make noise because it's like really weird if I do. Okay, yeah, so that makes sense for the emergency fund. And I don't know if you'll be able to answer, but I'm like, when it comes to budgeting, do you have like a rule that's you would recommend for people to follow? Like there's the 50, 30, 20%. Do you like ever recommend that? Do you have any other recommendation?
Yeah, that's a great point. There's a lot of financial gurus out
We're like,
there,
yeah.
yeah, promoting certain percentages or ratios or whatnot.
I know it depends on every case and
Yeah, that, and that's
everyone is different.
exactly. That's what I was going to put forward because it really depends
Yeah.
on your situation. Because if we take two examples, somebody who makes $30,000 a year versus somebody who makes $100,000 a year,
Yeah.
it wouldn't be fair to have the same, 50, 30, 20 rule
Yeah,
because
of course.
we
It's
all have
not.
a exactly, we all
Yeah.
have a basic cost of living, So the best way to plan the budget, first of all, it helps a lot if we have a fixed income versus a variable income,
Yeah.
which isn't always the case as a student. Obviously, with student jobs, it's more fluctuating. But once we actually have a stable job, or even if it's not that stable, we have at least a stable cash flow that's coming in. That's the
Yeah.
first step because from there we can say, okay, this is coming in almost for sure every 2 weeks or every month. From there, what are my fixed expenses? And I always start by that. So, what are fixed expenses? Obviously, let's say your cell phone or your
Yeah.
hydro, or everything that every month, this is gonna be coming out of my account. And from there, we often overestimate a variable expenses, such as maybe groceries or entertainment
Yeah.
expenses, things that we're gonna pay ourselves, but that we can never know exactly. So I often recommend to just round everything up to make sure that you have a bit more than not enough
Yeah.
at the end of the calculation. To include, as I said, paying yourself first in that calculation. And then whatever is left over is to di redistribute and decide, okay, what do we do with that money? Do we pay off
Yeah, I was
debts?
gonna
Do
ask.
we exactly, do we pay off debts? Do we invest more? And going right into that is, okay, do we pay off debt? Do we invest money? Obviously, it always depends of our objectives, meaning that if
Yeah.
we pay 10% on a certain debt right now, well, we're most likely going to be in a better situation to pay off that debt sooner than later because 10% is quite a bit of interest. Whereas if it's a debt where it's at 2 or 3% because we have a student loan, we have a good rate, then maybe we take a bit more time to pay off that debt and we're not as much in a hurry. So
Yeah.
that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is to look at the monthly payment as well. Is it reducing our cash flow? And the reason why is when we do go to a bank and ask for a mortgage, for example, the calculation that they use is the monthly income minus the monthly expenses. So if your payment for that loan is very high, and the best worst example I can give is for people with big car loans where they might pay $600 or $700 a month on a car. Well, that will really reduce the capacity of the mortgage they might be able to have because it's a very high payment
Yeah.
on regarding their income. So that's one way to
There
look at
isn't as much left in that, calculation than there would be if you didn't have that car payment to make or
it.
any
Exactly.
like large expenses.
Exactly.
Yeah. And when I was doing some research, I found something called the Canadian Deposit Insurance
The CIDC? Yes.
Corporation.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that or?
Of course. And that is a very I won't say popular, but it has come to the ears of a lot of people recently with the
Yeah.
news we've heard in the States and said bank, which was close to bankruptcy. Basically, what the CDIC is that it insures deposits in checking and savings accounts in big banks. So up to $100,000 in a checking account, for example, or in a savings account, is insured by the CIDC, meaning that if the bank goes bankrupt, well, if you have $120,000 in that account, well, there's only $100,000 that is guaranteed. So, or insured, I should say. So that's why we're often going to hear people say you shouldn't have all your money in one bank, for example, because if you do, let's say, have $300,000 in one bank and it goes bankrupt, well, you're losing two thirds of your money in that said account. So that's why the CIDC exists. Obviously, we're not at a very high risk in Canada, being one of the better banking systems worldwide, but obviously, we never know what might happen regarding that. So better be safe than sorry.
So you would recommend for people to kind of spread out their money in different banks or not necessarily?
Yes and no, because what's important to know is that the CIDC really applies only to accounts like checkings accounts, savings account, and things of that matter. So if somebody has like $300,000 or $400,000, I wouldn't recommend to keep all of that in checking accounts. Obviously, they would be better off to invest it. And that's where it's different, because when your money's invested with a certain bank, for example, or with Ferric, if you want to give the example, if you're invested in a mutual fund, well, for the fund to go to zero, we technically need all of the companies and the stocks and bonds inside that portfolio to actually declare bankruptcy. So it's not the entity necessarily holding the funds, it's the individual stocks and bonds inside the investment which would need to declare bankruptcy. So we're kind of disassociating from the risk. So it's two different factors. But to answer your question simply, obviously, I wouldn't recommend people to necessarily put money in different banks or have $100,000 in a checking account. It would be way better for them to start investing, depending on their objectives. But there's often different types of investment accounts that allows them to have lower risk if they need it in the short term, or higher risk if it's obviously for a more medium long term objective.
And can you explain like a bit about how investing works, like in a bit more detail? Is that something that we can
Yeah,
talk about?
of course, and it's the thing I love to talk the most about, honestly, for being honest, so I will
Perfect.
gladly do so. So investing, especially in mutual funds, which is what most people who don't want to manage their own money, or I should say most investments, will get into, is what we call mutual funds. And a mutual fund is basically a basket of different stocks and bonds, as I mentioned. So, to give an analogy, if we go to the groceries, obviously, we're gonna want to diversify our nutrition. We're not gonna go to groceries and just pick up fruits, for example. We're gonna pick up fruits and vegetables and, cereal and bread and
I
whatever,
mean, don't forget, you're
milk
talking to a
products.
student here, so I mean, there
Yeah.
isn't that
Well,
much variety
that's,
in
I'm
growth.
trying to promote diversity in every way today, as much for nutrition as for
Fair enough.
investing. But the analogy is basically a portfolio of stocks and bonds, or a fund of stocks and bonds. It's going to diversify to reduce the risk. So whether that be, well, there's three big main ways I like to discuss risk, or diversifying risk, I should say. The first one is through economies of scale. What that means is that we won't invest in one or two specific companies, because if we do that, oftentimes it can go really well or really bad. If the company, if we invested in Tesla and Amazon 5 years ago, we're more than happy today. But if we invested in other companies who declare bankruptcy, not as happy. So the point of diversification through economies of scale is to invest in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies, so that even if five of them declare bankruptcy tomorrow, it won't have a dramatic impact on the performance of the portfolio. It will be minute. So that's the first aspect. The second aspect of diversification is through geographic allocation. So yes, in Canada, in the States, in Asia, in Europe, etc. So we really want to diversify globally, because it's never one, geographic region performing the best all the time. It's volatile. Sometimes
Of
it's the States,
course.
sometimes it's Europe, and it changes year by year, So that's the second part of it. And the third one, which I think is one of the most important, is to diversify in different industry sectors. So not just in banks or just in technology. We have, in science, in manufacturing, in retail, et cetera, about 10 to 15 different broad sectors. And once again, is the principle of not putting all our eggs in the same basket. Whereas if one industry goes, down, the other one can alleviate and whatnot. So it's really about finding a good balance, and in the medium to long term, have better returns with said investments, because mutual funds often have a longer term horizon with that money. The plan isn't to double your money next year and find the company that's gonna, do really
Yeah, it's
well
gonna
within the
boom or.
next year. Exactly. It's not a speculative business. It's a business where we look at the medium to long term performance of said companies, and often companies that will be able to thrive and survive through recessions, for example, if we would want to get into that and everything associated. So it's really a different aspect, and looking at companies 5 to 10 years down the road right away as at today, and not, okay, just next year, because we don't know what's going to happen in the next year or two, especially in the current economy we live in with, all the said factors that we are all aware about. We never know what might obviously happen in the short term.
I mean, take COVID, for example. None of us
COVID,
knew that
exactly. We have COVID, we have the war, we have,
was gonna happen. Exactly.
everything associated with that, which was not expected at all.
100%. Before we end on this, I just wanted to ask if you wanted to talk about the competitions that will be taking place.
Yes, of course. So, before I get into that, I do want to discuss a bit more who Ferric is and what we do, because I did discuss it briefly at the beginning, but I want to, because I did mention we're a nonprofit organization, but obviously, nonprofit organizations in the financial industry is not something you see every day. So let me explain what that entails specifically.
Perfect.
So firstly, obviously, we cannot declare legally a profit. In the title, it says it, nonprofit organization. So when we have a surplus at the end of the year as a company, we have to redistribute that money towards our clients. So there's actually a couple of ways we can do that. We can reduce our management expense ratios, which is the fee as of the investments. We can hire new staff to alleviate our service. We can even work on specific projects such as remodeling our website, for example, which we are currently doing right now. But that obviously allows us to, being a nonprofit organization, as well have unbiased conversation advices with individuals, because we're not commission
Of
based, we're all
course.
salaried, so it allows us to have a different approach than what we might see elsewhere. And to simply compare the management fees, which I mentioned briefly before, the median of the industry is usually closer to about 2% in management fees, and at Ferric, our funds and portfolios are closer to 1%. So that 1% is actually money that's saved, so hence more return in the client's pockets at the end of the year. And obviously, 1% per year over 10, 20, 30 years, you see the impact of compound interest, and that,
It
can
adds up.
apply, exactly, adds up to a lot more. And Ferric currently actually manages about $3.5 billion in assets, which is represented by about just under 24,000 clients. So even though we're a nonprofit organization, we still have a growth objective, because the bigger we become, the more money we have to redistribute to our clients to better our services, to reduce our management fees. So that's why we, even though we're a nonprofit organization, we still try to put ourselves out there in the very competitive financial industry to try to show that we can give great advice and do it in a way that is very different from what we see from other businesses.
Okay, amazing. Thank you for that. I was
It's
actually wondering how that worked, but I was gonna ask you like later, but I'm glad you brought it up now so that everyone can learn.
Yeah, exactly. And it is confusing. Oftentimes people get surprised when I say nonprofit organization in the financial industry. They kind of, I see their faces light up. So that's why I took the time to say it. And if ever people do want to speak with a Ferric advisor, they can call our advisory line, which is available from 8 to 8 weekdays, Fridays from 8 to 5. And there's also ways to open their accounts themselves online. We have a chat available on our website as well. We can book appointments with advisors directly through Zoom calls. So there's a multitude of channels that you can communicate with us.
It seems also really easy to be able to access them and for people to find them.
Exactly. We actually have a policy internally that we try to answer, or we must answer our clients within 2 minutes. And 2 minutes is actually a red flag for us. We actually try to answer within 90 seconds, just to give you an idea of how we give ourselves pressure internally to really give a good customer service. So we really bring that forth a lot.
That's impressive, honestly. That's really cool. Amazing.
All right.
Okay.
Perfect.
And
And
the competition.
Yes, I do want to discuss briefly the competition. So I'd like to invite you all to go to our website to view our recent episode, our first and recent episode of Les Anges du Génie, which is a new contest this year with $35,000 in prizes to be won. So these prizes are actually given to student projects in the engineering field who demonstrate multiple criteria such as sustainable development and innovation and whatnot. And there was actually over 50 projects submitted from six different universities. And there were six finalists, which were all chosen to participate for that episode. And each of these six finalists will leave with a cash prize from that $35,000.
Okay.
So out of the six finalists, there's actually one group from Concordia, Insight Wear AI, which are presented by the brothers Wassim and Khalil Dijawi. Pardon me if I don't pronounce that well. I do obviously encourage you guys to go see your peers. I don't want to
Yeah.
spoil any details, but I can't say that they were very much liked by our jury and by the public. So I do invite you all to go see the episode to congratulate your peers and inspire yourself for next year's edition if you would like to participate.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Thank you
Tamara, for having
for
me. It was a pleasure to be able to discuss this with you today.
coming and for, telling us all about homeownership and all the different accounts and answering my questions. I actually learned a lot from just today's episode, so thank you so much. And I will see you guys next time or the next episode. Bye, everyone.